Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And with us today, we have Fiorella De Maria. She was born in Italy of Maltese parents. She grew up in Wiltshire, England, and attended Cambridge, where she received a BA in English Literature and a Master's in Renaissance Literature, specializing in the English verse of Robert Southwell. She lives in Surrey with her husband and four children. She is a winner of the National Book Prize of Malta. She's published several novels, and we'll cover those today and Catholic fiction in general. Welcome to the show, Fiorella.
Hello. It's good to be on the show.
Excellent. So to start off, you have the distinct pleasure of being the first fiction author I've interviewed on the show. So what draws you to the fiction genre as a writer?
Well, I have always wanted to be a writer ever since I think I was 7 years old. I've always loved storytelling. I grew up with it. I grew up with, you know, my grandmother telling me stories about her past, stories about Malta's past. I loved the idea of creating characters as of going on that adventure. So in some ways, I don't think I chose it really. It chose me. Mm-hmm. I found it such a natural genre to go into.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the challenges in writing for the fiction genre compared to someone who might be writing nonfiction?
Well, I think it starts off that the first challenge is why you are writing. And I think one of the reasons why Catholic fiction particularly sometimes can falter a little bit, I mean, aspiring Catholic writers can struggle, is that if you start with the idea of a message you want to promote or an idea you want to examine, I think you can always be in danger of not writing a novel at all, just writing a sort of form of propaganda with mm-hmm. fictional characters. So I think one of the biggest challenges is to actually lose yourself in the art of storytelling. That first and foremost, you are a storyteller, you are a fiction writer, but you write within the Catholic moral universe. And if you commend it all to the glory of God, then the truth that you're exploring, it should just come naturally. But the first challenge is to write a good story.
Mm, definitely. So it seems that Catholic fiction is finally starting to get a foothold in the literary world. And I often found it, in my 7 years reviewing books, that it was difficult to seek out and find Catholic fiction, but that seems to be changing. Have you noticed that as well as an author?
Yes, I have. It's a very, very encouraging trend, something I've noticed really in the last 10 years or so, particularly. I mean, we get very nostalgic about Catholic fiction of the past, Evelyn Waugh, Graham Greene, these names always come up when we're talking about Catholic fiction. But there was suddenly quite a gap, I feel, where the Catholic fiction just didn't seem to be there. It didn't seem to be coming through. I mean, there were novelists like Piers Paul Reid, for example, who were writing, but there just seemed to be a little bit of a gap somehow. And I think that's been filled. You've got a generation now of Catholic writers who are very dedicated to their art, but who are also being given a platform. Publishers like Ignatius Press have opened up their fiction catalogue, are accepting fiction. You've got also Catholic magazines like Dappled Things, for example, which offer a lot of encouragement to aspiring Catholic writers. So there are, I think there are the writers there, but there's also the platform growing and also the readership. Because there's no point in writing a book if you don't have readers.
All right, that's a good point. So I want to start going through your different novels you have and examining them a bit. So the first one I want to look at is the title Do No Harm. So can you give us an overview of what that book is about?
Well, I first had the idea of writing that because I was involved in some campaigning work connected up with end-of-life care in Britain. There was a bill going through Parliament that was going to make it very difficult for doctors who refused to withdraw food and fluids, for example, for a patient so that they would die of dehydration. And I was at a conference where the subject came up, and I just thought, what would actually happen to a doctor if he was faced with a living will that told him not to treat a patient or to withhold treatment or care from a patient, and in good conscience he couldn't do it? And that is the dilemma, that's the huge dilemma that the doctor faces in Do No Harm. A young woman is brought to him unconscious, she can't make any kind of a statement to him verbally, but she has this living will that says she does not want to be treated, she doesn't want to be resuscitated, she's made a suicide attempt. And he makes the decision to save her. He knows how to save her. He can't bear the idea of standing back and letting her die when he can't even be sure that she really meant it, in the, when it actually came to it, that she really would want to die. That's one of the big problems with living wills, is you never really know how you would feel when it came to it.
Right.
And so the book then really examines what happens to him and what could happen to a doctor within the British legal system if they were prosecuted.
Right. Now, when you're writing this, and particularly the doctor's name in this novel is Dr. Kemble, when you're writing this, did you go out to actual sources and talk to them, or was this all written from what you think would happen?
Oh, no, it was all written from interviews and research. It's one of the common problems when you're writing a historical novel, instinctively you know you have to do a lot of research because it's in the past and there's a lot of details you won't know. But even writing a contemporary novel, there's a lot of detail you just don't know as a layman unless you go out there and talk to people. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a lawyer. So I spent hours talking to senior medical consultants, barristers, court lawyers. Okay. And also reading transcripts of medical trials to get a feel for what it's like. Because if you think about it, in your day-to-day life, you might find yourself in a hospital, but if you're being rushed into accident and emergency or the emergency room, you're probably not thinking about the details. You're not in a position to absorb the atmosphere. So there'll be a lot of things you don't know. And if you're lucky, you'll never find yourself in court. So they're actually quite closed worlds unless you actually work in them. So it took a lot of conversation, and I found, in fact, I had a lot of misconceptions about the way medicine works, about the way the law works. And, you know, there were some fairly painful rewrites had to go on just to make it realistic. But that's a big part of writing, I find, is that experts can be incredibly generous with their time when it comes to answering questions. Otherwise, it would be impossible, I think.
Got it. So was there anything you discovered while writing this novel, Do No Harm, that you did not realize before you took up the process of writing it?
I think I didn't fully appreciate how incredibly stressful it would be for an innocent man to find himself on trial. it's easy enough to think about it. You know, we've all seen films, you know, movies where someone's on trial for their life or whatever, and it's very dramatic. But when I was really going through the details of it and trying to live that experience with Matthew Kemble, who's a very unlikely hero, he doesn't want to get thrust into the situation. He's quite a nervous hero in many ways. It really made me think a lot about how much of an impact that sort of situation would have on a family, on the person individually, on them mentally, spiritually. You know, it really did make me realize what a huge sacrifice that would be.
Now, recently we had the Alfie Evans case. And was there anything that occurred as that unfolded that that didn't surprise you from what you researched for this book? Or did that kind of unfold the way you thought it might based upon what you have discovered when writing Do No Harm?
I never thought for a moment, I'm afraid, that the parents would be successful, which is a hard thing to say. And the same was true with the Charlie Gard case, because cases I've seen like that in the past, generally they tend to rule with the hospital. The fact is, hospitals have in-house lawyers. I think the legal bill for the hospital of the Alfie Evans case was something like £140,000. So, you know, they know what they're doing. They go in there with an advantage. The medical experts are all obviously going to be on their side. So I think these cases are always very stacked in favour of the hospital. However, I would say that both the Alfie Evans cases and the Charlie Gard case were very, very complex medically. I mean, my feeling was I didn't like the way the parents were treated. I did not like the fact that they lost their rights to make decisions about their children. I felt, in fact, it was more a parental rights issue than a pro-life issue in many ways. You know, what happened to the parents and the way they lost the right to be involved with their child's medical care, I found more disturbing. Mm-hmm. But there have also been cases involving adults who, for example, there was a case years ago of a young woman who, like the character in my story, made a suicide attempt, had a letter from her solicitor saying she didn't want to be treated, and she wasn't treated because the doctor thought he would be arrested for assault, and she died. And that caused quite a lot of discussion at the time because there were psychiatrists, for example, saying this woman was mentally ill. If she'd had the treatment she needed, she could have gone on to lead a perfectly happy and healthy life. She was not in a position to make a decision like that. Right. But, you know, if you have living wills codified into law, it's always going to create these terrible situations, and particularly the reclassifying of food and fluids as medical treatment rather than care adds another layer of complications to that, because you can starve a person to death, you can dehydrate a person to death, and that can be legal because it's regarded as medical care being withheld, mm-hmm. not neglect. So it's, you know, it's a very complex area, and it was one of the reasons I wanted really to explore it, because right. I felt that it's not something I felt we really, particularly when the law was changing, that people really took particularly seriously just the huge consequences it was going to have.
Right. And all that discussion from Catholic Fiction. And we'll be back after a quick break to talk more about the positives of Catholic Fiction. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
Marriage is ordered between one man and one woman because, like God's love, it is called to be fruitful. Open to life. Well, there's a lot of confusion in the culture today, but here is some clarity in the following beautiful quote from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, 2335. Each of the two sexes is an image of the power and tenderness of God, with equal dignity, though in a different way. The union of man and woman in marriage is a way of imitating in the flesh the Creator's generosity and fecundity. End quote. Listen, be not afraid. Couples that are willing to live openness to life in their marriage will receive not only many spiritual benefits, but a very practical strengthening of their marriage. I'm Jim Littleton, formingfaithfulfamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. With us today, we have Fiorella De Maria. She is a Catholic fiction author with quite a stable of novels we're going through here today. We talked last segment about Do No Harm, and this segment, one of the books I want to talk about is Poor Banished Children. So, Fiorella, can you give us an overview of what that book covers?
I always wanted to write Poor Banished Children. It was the book right when I was a teenager that I was always working towards writing. I'm very aware of coming from a country which has a history of slavery, which is not very well known. I always wanted to write something about it because I felt that really the story of my own people, the Mediterranean slave trade, had never really been told. And the tragedy is that slavery has touched virtually every culture in the world. Mm-hmm. And so, but it was such a huge project to write a book about the 17th century slave trade. I knew it would take a huge amount of research, and even emotionally and artistically, it was going to be such a huge project that I felt I had to have a few other novels under my belt before I could even think about writing it. And it was a huge emotional roller coaster for me writing that because I felt as if I was writing, well, I was writing about my own people. Mm-hmm. I come from slave ancestry myself, I discovered actually as I was writing the book. So it felt very personal. Really, the book, I was seeking to try to expose the atrocities that were carried out on Christian slaves in North Africa, just to open up that very little known chapter.
Mm-hmm. So this book is more of a historical novel, whereas mm-hmm. Do No Harm's more of a current events type fiction.
Yes, that's right. Do No Harm is sort of set in and around London in the early millennium. So I'd say it's set about sort of 10, 15 years ago. But yes, it's very much a contemporary novel, whereas Poor Banished Children took me right back mm-hmm. to the 1630s and 40s. So a completely different world, very banished world, about which there is a lot less written.
Right.
I had to delve very, very deeply just to try to get information, particularly about what happened to women in the slave trade. There mm-hmm. are quite a few accounts of men, but not so many about women, mostly because women very rarely escaped and were very rarely ever freed.
Okay.
So they didn't get the opportunity to tell their story. And also there were priests who ministered very courageously to slaves out in North Africa, but they tended to be a little bit shy about writing about what happened to the women because it was so degrading.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of almost didn't want to humiliate them, I think, by going into a lot of detail. So I had to really read quite obscure accounts of what happened and talk to experts. Again, like with Do No Harm,
mm-hmm.
I spent hours and hours talking to experts in the history of Islam, in the history of the slave trade, and maritime history, just to bring all of those threads together.
So being that the subject matter of this novel is more hidden by the curtains of time, shall we say, was the research involved with this, did it take you longer to put all those pieces together than when you're writing something, say, like Do No Harm, that's a more of a current event thing where some of the pieces of the puzzle are more apparent and easier to grasp?
Mm. Much, much more, much longer. The novel and Poor Banished Children took me a year to research before I even put pen to paper. I mean, before I even started writing, it was a year in the reading interviews. I was quite lucky in that I was living in Cambridge at the time, and I had access to the big university library there, which had, you know, a manuscript room and very old books and things like that, but also did have a lot of experts in obscure areas who were extremely generous with their time.
Mm-hmm.
But even with a lot of help, it still was a year. And then it took another year in the writing because, in fact, the sketchy idea I had for the book completely changed during the research. I discovered that, in fact, my original story wouldn't work at all in that context. So I had to make huge changes.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to talk about was, you know, you at the beginning of, and this deals with Catholic fiction in itself and fiction writing in itself. In the beginning, you may have this notion of what the book's going to be like, but unlike reading nonfiction, which is, you know, here are the facts, here's how I'm going to relay this. Fiction, you're building a story. So how often does that happen in the process that the product you end up with isn't really what you thought it was going to be when you started researching?
I find that's quite common, certainly with me. I think it depends a little bit on how the writer approaches the story. Some writers write very, very detailed plans before they start, so they have a very good idea of which direction that the novel is going to go in. I find when I'm writing murder mysteries, I do have to write very detailed plans because, of course, you have to make sure the clues come out at the right sort of time, that there aren't any plot holes, that it all links up together nicely. But when I'm writing my other novels, I actually like the sense of adventure. I don't write detailed plans. I'll have a vague sketch of where the story arc is going and who the main characters are. And I'll write the first chapter, and then I'll write the climactic chapter, which usually isn't the last chapter. Mm. But I usually find that I end up rewriting the climactic chapter because the story will inevitably move in a different direction. Because, of course, if you create realistic characters, they won't necessarily do exactly what you want. You'll suddenly realise that a character's personality is developed in such a way that, well, they wouldn't forgive that person. They would try to get revenge, or, you know, they wouldn't go back to their family in that point. They'd do something else. You know, you start to realise that the decisions they would make are different to the decisions you wanted to make for them. Mm. And because characters do drive a story so much, then that's one of the major reasons, I think, where stories tend to change. And sometimes it's also having less understanding of a period when you begin. So, for example, when I started writing Poor Banished Children, I thought I knew the period quite well because I'd grown up on stories of brides being snatched on their wedding nights by pirates. I mean, it's a huge part of the Maltese folklore. But I didn't really know quite how terrible it was. I didn't know what the day-to-day details would have been like for people in that situation. And it's when you start to piece together those details that the story inevitably starts to take on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm. Now, you briefly mentioned this a bit when we started talking about this book, about the personal connection you had with the subject matter that was in Poor Banished Children. Did that make it more difficult for you to write this, that you had more of a personal investment in, or did it make it easier?
Oh, no, much harder, I have to say. I found it personally very, very challenging to write the book. I actually became very depressed at one point. I felt as if I was going back and trying to understand what it was like for my ancestors. You know, it was just personal on a level that nothing else I'd ever written was in the same way. And realizing the extent to which people suffered, and that it happened in places that are familiar to me. The heroine gets snatched from a bit of coastline that I'm very familiar with, that I've walked along. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, she came from the same culture, the same religious background that I do. She had a name that felt very familiar. I mean, all of these details, just the whole backstory she has, the story she grew up being told about St. Paul being shipwrecked on the island, all of this sort of thing that I would have grown up with. I think it made a connection that I found very powerful, but also very difficult. And yet at the same time, I think that was one of the major things that drove it, because at one point I found it so depressing as a story, just the whole period. I just didn't really want to complete it. And friends were saying to me, well, you know, if you don't write the story of your own people, nobody else is going to. So it's, I suppose,
point.
There was that side of things that really motivated me to keep going with it as well.
Excellent. We're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media, and we'll be right back.
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land gift shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. Today we've been chatting with Fiorella De Maria. She's a Catholic fiction author writer. And we've talked about two of your titles. I'd like to move on to a third one. It's called We'll Never Tell Them. So can you tell us a bit about that one?
Well, the First World War, a bit like the slave trade, it's a period I'm very familiar with. I studied it at school. All British school children learn about the First World War. And so it was a period I felt comfortable with. I felt that I knew a little bit about. But I wanted to write a little bit about the Malta connection because that's very little known. We know a lot about trenches and the Western Front and all of that side of things. But I knew that there was a whole story there about the hospitals, for example, where the wounded were taken from Gallipoli that hadn't been told. And the whole idea for it came from a photograph, in fact. I was shown an old photograph of, it was my husband's grandfather as a baby being held by his mother. Very typical photograph, smiling mother, little plump little baby. And I was shown it, in fact, to be demonstrated how much my own children looked like him, which they did. But what I noticed the most was, in fact, the woman. And I just thought, what a tragic generation you were. You know, you saw your husbands and sweethearts go off to the First World War, and then your sons went off to fight again just a few years later. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was a POW, in fact, during the Second World War. He was the war generation. He was 18 in 1939. And it was really the suffering of the women left behind that I just wanted to really explore in the novel. So I have a Maltese heroine, and she does spend most of the war in Malta. You see the Sacra Infermeria, you see the hospitals being converted for the war wounded, but it's very much looking at the First World War from the perspective of a civilian.
Got it.
But a lot of it's about that sense of loss and disconnection.
So I guess one of the things I want to ask is, as a general overview question, what draws you to these topics you write about? Obviously, Poor Banished Children had a personal connection in the fact that you wanted to look at the sort of a family history of your own, and this one was drawn out of a photograph. Is this just things that happen to you that draw you into writing these, or how do you go about deciding what you're going to write about?
It tends to be, I mean, it probably seems quite random, but it does tend to be moments like that. It'll start with an idea, like, say, the photograph of the woman staring into the camera, or a particular period I have an interest in. There's a novel I've just signed a contract for, in fact, that's set in a boarding school in 1940. And I got the idea for that because I was doing a clear out of my books, of which I have many, as you can imagine. And I found a whole lot of schoolgirl stories, which, you know, a lot of girls grow up reading, you know, boarding school stories. I don't know how, if they're as popular in the States, but a lot of girls read them, and they're all quite harmless, you know, hockey matches and, you know, girls getting into mischief, and, you know, you get the idea. And when I was reading that, I thought, okay, but what if it was real? What if a girl in a boarding school really did believe there was an imposter on the premises? What would actually happen? Mm-hmm. Because what inevitably happens in these schoolgirl stories is that there's a spy on the premises, or there's a baddie of some kind, and they have to band together and do something about it. Mm-hmm. And of course, nobody ever gets hurt, and, you know, it's all done in between netball matches and things, and, you know, the life of the school isn't even really interrupted very much. And so that was, again, just an idea that came up when I was looking through some books. So it usually is something as small as that. And some ideas don't go anywhere. I'll sketch out a possible plot, a few characters, and it just doesn't somehow come together, and I'll put it to one side. Other times it kind of comes to life, and I just think, right, yes, I really want to go down this road. Because mm-hmm. it's a long road. You know, you're talking a year.
Yeah,
you know, to write a novel. So you have to be writing about something that's going to maintain your interest, because mm-hmm. if the writer's not interested, then the reader's not going to be interested.
Correct.
You know, if the writer's not doesn't care about the characters, then you're not going to get anyone else to care about mm-hmm. them.
Now, when you set out to write fiction, particularly in the Catholic genre, to get that Catholic fiction novel, there obviously has to be some Catholic elements within it. So do you go about looking for stories that have that already in, or do you find ways to weave that within the storyline that you're creating?
There are moments where a, a particular idea will come to mind, which I will deliberately weave into a story. So, for example, in Poor Banished Children, there's a moment where the priest is giving the last rites to a dying sailor. And there's a lot of reference in it to mercy and forgiveness. And the sailor is very grateful that he is receiving the consolation of Holy Church before he dies, even though he's got very little to be grateful for. And the reason I put that in fact, is when I was doing my research, I came across stories of priests who did that, who would go with oils to the ports when the galleys were coming in, because they knew that there would be men there who were dying, and the only thing they could do for them, they couldn't free them or ransom them, the only thing they could do was to anoint them. And I found that detail so impressive that I found a way to put it into the book. But a lot of the time, the themes just come. I won't set out to include a theme of redemption, for example. It's just the way the story will go, because getting back to what we were saying earlier, I feel that if you write within the Catholic moral universe, those themes will simply permeate the writing. You won't even have to try. It will just happen. The hero will be searching for redemption, mm-hmm. And will find it, you know, right. Hopefully if they make the right choices, you know, they will face dilemmas. They will fall into sin. There will be all sorts of moments that they have to, where they have to, you know, negotiate their way through the moral complexities of daily life. Mm-hmm. But I find generally, you know, if you keep focused on the faith, you commend. I mean, every time I write, I try to remember to commend everything to the glory of God. Then it will all be shot through with those themes. The Catholicism will be there, sometimes quite subtly, but it will be there.
Gotcha. Now, you've kind of alluded this to a bit a couple times. You mentioned it, the length of time it takes to do the research and write each book. Mm-hmm. Do you find that at the end of a project, you just want to step away, or do you go into another one pretty soon after?
I go into a project pretty quickly. I hate not being writing. I hate not having a project to work on. I'm not an easy person to live with if I don't have something to create. But I think that's the same is true of all writers. I think there's a quote somebody sent me saying a non-writing writer is a monster courting insanity. I think it's Kafka said that. So make sure it's good for my family if I'm writing. So what I tend to do is I always plan at least to have one book in final production, you know, final editing and all of that with the publisher, another book on the publisher's desk, as it were, waiting to be seen, and another one that I'm writing. So I'll be creating, waiting, and polishing.
All at the same time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to take one more quick break, and we'll be back here on Off the Shelf, and we'll be talking about mystery novels written by Fiorella De Maria. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
I have a quiz for you. What is one of the greatest gifts parents can give to their children? It's something children ask for often. When this gift is received, the entire family is incredibly joyful and transformed on the special occasion of the arrival of this masterpiece. This gift calls for faith, courage, and generosity on the part of the givers. It lasts for many decades, only getting better, changing, and developing each day. This magnificent gift is unique and can never be repeated, but a similar gift can be added approximately every year. This gift can only be given by three persons agreeing and acting. Have you guessed it yet? Yes, this profound gift is that of welcoming another child. And the three persons agreeing are husband, wife, and God. I'm Jim Littleton, forming faithfulfamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. We've been spending the day with Fiorella De Maria. She is a Catholic fiction author. And now we're going to head into obviously fiction, but sort of a subgenre of fiction that is mysteries. Can you tell us a bit about your Father Gabriel mysteries?
Well, My dirty little secret is I love crime fiction. I love Agatha Christie, Conan Doyle, you name it. I read them, I watch them, I love trying to work them out. I think I read my first Sherlock Holmes when I was 7, and I scared myself half to death reading it. And it happened to be, I happened to pick up one of the most sinister Sherlock Holmes mysteries without realizing it.
Yeah.
But I was hooked. I just loved the idea of that puzzle. And so I've always had a kind of little ambition to write my own crime fiction. And the idea for it really came, I wanted the sleuth to be a Benedictine. I grew up near a community of Benedictines, so I'm very familiar with that community and their ethos and in the rule of Saint Benedict. And I spent many happy hours talking to the prior of the local Benedictine Abbey about just the way of life. I like the idea of a priest sleuth, because I think there's something about a man who's saving souls, trying to solve a crime, you're trying to get to the truth. And I decided to set it in the late 40s, you know, quite soon after the war, because I felt it was a very interesting time for Britain in terms of social change. Mm. You know, the war's over, but it's a big time of austerity. Britain's position in the world is changing. The welfare state is being built, the National Health Service, all of this, you know, quite big changes within society. And a lot of people suffering, a lot of people trying to come to terms with their war history. Many who will have lost a loved one, who lost their homes, who've maybe witnessed things, who've been out fighting, struggling to deal with civilian life. So it's a very, very rich vein for any kind of creative writing, but particularly mystery, because you'll also have a lot of people who are trying to hide their pasts, who have constructed an identity for themselves, people settling scores, you can imagine. It's very, very fertile ground.
Mm-hmm. So the first one you, Father Gabriel, mystery you wrote was The Sleeping Witness. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of that one?
Yes, it's one of these stories where two people are found in a pool of blood in a cottage. One of them's dead. The woman is in a coma, not expected to wake up. It looks as if they've been caught in a compromising situation. The woman's husband is found nearby and is presumed to be the killer. The thought is it's a crime of passion. But of course, if a person is caught practically with a smoking gun in his hand, he didn't do it. And so Father Gabriel, you know, gets the sense that he is in fact telling the truth, that he is innocent. And he goes with his gut instinct. Everything suggests that the doctor did it. But he somehow knows it wasn't him, and so the whole story is trying to work out not just who done it, but what the real identities of those two people are. Is there something in their past that links them? And why were they together? What were they doing in that cottage? Mm-hmm. And who was it who had an interest in silencing them?
In the second most recent one released is The Vanishing Woman. What's the backstory to that title?
Well, the mystery is that you have a young woman living in an isolated cottage. She sees her elderly mother walking along the tree-lined path to the house. It's a very unpopular woman, got enemies everywhere. And as she's walking towards the house, the daughter is distracted for a moment, taking the kettle off the hob, comes back, and the woman is gone. And she has completely disappeared. There's no sign she was ever standing on that path.
Hmm.
And so it's not just it's not so much a whodunit, it's what happened.
Right.
Is the girl out of her mind? Was she deceived? Or has something more sinister happened?
Now, it seems that, to me, this subgenre of fiction that you're writing here in these murder mysteries, you probably have a little bit more freer rein in what you do. How much work goes into compiling one of these types of works?
I find that the actual writing of them is a lot quicker than my literary fiction, but so much of it depends upon the puzzle. The most time I find that I have to take is in actually constructing the murder mystery or the kidnap or the mystery, whatever the mystery is, mm-hmm. and working out the different players and working out the red herrings, the twists and turns. You know, I have to start with a basic sketch. Then I have to build up the characters, and they each have to have a written profile, their ages, their relationships with one another, because otherwise you end up tripping over yourself all over the place. And then I have to write quite a detailed chapter by chapter plan to make sure that the story unfolds the way it needs to. But once I've done all of that, that is the bulk of the work. The actual writing comes quite naturally. Because sort of almost all the donkey work's already been done.
Right, right. Is this subgenre more enjoyable to you than writing the other?
I enjoy it. Yes, I find it enjoyable. I like the fact that I'm now writing a series, so I can really get to know the characters better. Mm-hmm. It's the first time I've had, you know, the same character, in fact, characters, because of course it's a religious community, who keep cropping up in each book. You get the same detective inspector. Not only do you have the same detective, you know, central detective, but you also have his friends and his brothers. I really enjoy that side of it. Mm-hmm. I don't find it as artistically challenging, I have to say, as writing, say, historical fiction.
Right.
Because crime fiction is quite formulaic. There are certain expectations. There is a crime. There are certain clues. There are false turns that have to be taken, misdirection, a denouement. I think Agatha Christie more or less set the formula, and with certain mm-hmm. variants, there's an expectation that you keep to, you know, more or less the same sort of formula. So that is a little bit more restrictive, though these days you can be a lot more creative with detective fiction. You know, you can take liberties, give a bit more depth to the characters. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Father Gabriel has a history of his own. He's a late vocation. And during the novels, you just get little glimpses into his past life and the things he doesn't talk about. And so the characters don't just have to be types. You know, you can allow them to be more flesh and blood characters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will there be more Father Gabriel mysteries?
I'm working on one at the moment.
Awesome. Good deal. So now we've opened that door. What projects are you currently working on that you can share with us?
Well, I have a nonfiction book coming out later this year on pro-life feminism.
Okay.
It's called The Abolition of Woman. That's my first nonfiction book, so that's a big step for me. But it's based very much on years and years of campaigning work and research into this subject. But I've got hopefully another novel coming out next year, and I'm hoping possibly another Father Gabriel.
Excellent. Now, that nonfiction work, as you're writing that, are you finding that there's differences between the research you're doing for the fiction, or is that pretty much you following the same path as you would any other work you've done?
Well, research is research on one level, and the sort of research skills I've developed in the field of bioethics over the years very much has its roots in the research skills I learned as a student when I was studying English literature. So there is quite a bit of crossover, but with nonfiction, it's much more like investigative journalism in a way, a lot more statistics, a lot more facts and figures. Having to be a lot more careful, a lot more precise about your sources. Because, for example, if I'm writing a novel set, well, just after the Second World War, I'll do a fair amount of reading around it. I'll talk to a lot of people. But it's unlikely anybody's going to pick me up on something and say, are you absolutely sure he said that? Or are you absolutely sure he ate that for dinner? Or, you know, were pork pies available at the time or whatever? Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be a pedant who would, but when it comes to nonfiction, particularly something extremely contentious, which I know is going to be nitpicked quite heavily by my opponents, every single source has to be reliable, it has to be available. I found that whole process of making sure that absolutely every footnote made sense and every footnote could be accessed easily. It was quite exhausting, but that's something where you have to be a lot more precise with mm-hmm. nonfiction, I think.
Hmm. Well, Fiorella, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule today. We've come to the end of the show. Any closing thoughts?
We need more Catholic writers. If you have a book in you, get down there and write it.
Just
sit at your desk and write it.
Yep. Excellent advice. And with that, you can listen to Off the Shelf.